rather beautiful tune brings us to the start of the Ralph Winterhoad show, and you'll probably notice that this person speaking doesn't sound anything like Ralph Winterhoad, and therefore if your observing ears are tuned, you'll know that it's not Ralph Winterhoad, it's somebody else. And my name is Andrew Johnson, and on the program with me this evening, this afternoon, this morning, wherever you may be, whatever time it is, I have my very good friend Dr. Judy Wood, and we're going to cover some of the things that we're interested in, which Ralph has very kindly covered with us on various occasions, and we're very grateful for the time that he's given to us over the last few years to bring to you some of the very important information which Dr. Judy Wood has been compiling and sort of studying since probably about 2001, 2002, if the truth be known. And so with that general introduction, well, let me say that we're going to try and take some callers in the second hour. It's not something I'm totally used to, so I may bumble through this slightly, but the call-in number is 1-800-313-9443, and we can try and take your questions and take your comments, which today's programme will be focused around the events of 9/11, as I say, so we'll probably be best to ask us questions about that. So really, I'll probably start off just by introducing who we are, in case you've not heard of us before. It may be all new to you for all we know, we can't tell, because we're very distant from you. As I say, my name is Andrew Johnson, and as you can probably tell, I'm not a US resident. I'm not in the state of Alaska as Ralph is. I actually live in the UK, and my background is in software engineering, and I've done quite a bit of that in the past, although I don't do as much these days, and I actually do some tutoring and assessing of students for an organisation called the Open University. And through my academic background, or of sorts, my humble academic background, I came into contact with a lady called Dr. Judy Wood in probably 2006, I think it was, that we first came into contact. And it was because we have a mutual interest in the truth about what happened on 9/11. And we found ourselves exploring this in various ways. Dr. Wood has been doing it in very minute detail. And I've sort of been following several tens of steps behind her most of the time, certainly for the first few years. And so I'd just like to sort of check that she's still there and we've still got the Skype connections up and things. And are you there, Dr. Judy Wood?
Yes, hello. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, it's a little while since we've done one of these programs together. I think the last time was with Ralph, maybe it must have been about a year ago or something, or maybe longer. So I think I've given a bit of a general introduction. I may get cut off by the music because I'm not entirely sure the exact timings of the breaks here. I think, we could write them down somewhere. But, perhaps, Dr. Wood, if you'd like to introduce yourself for people who don't know much about you and a bit of your background and things.
Okay, I'm a forensic scientist, have been one my whole life. Bachelor's degree in civil engineering, master's degree in engineering mechanics, which is like applied physics, and a PhD in materials engineering science, which is an interdisciplinary degree of studies. But my main area of focus, has been experimental mechanics. That is looking at what really is there. Measuring something in reality, not mathematical models and so forth. A lot of people have trouble understanding what experimental mechanics is. And my particular area of expertise is using optical methods in interferometry to measure deformations of materials for material characterization. So unknown materials, measuring how the material actually behaves in a really good hands-on physical idea of how materials normally behave, and also a focus on that. So also with my entire career has been spent on image analysis.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of areas that you get into when you're doing that sort of work. And, you know, it is very much hands-on, as you say. And, you know, one of the key skills, and we'll probably talk a bit more about this, is observation, isn't it, of actually what's in front of you and what's going on, and breaking that down. You know, and as you say, very importantly, one of the basis in sciences, or one of the main bases of things, is to how you measure things, how you make measurements. And, you know, that's how you begin to quantify your observations and actually determine what is happening in front of you and what's likely to happen next, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important that people appreciate the background that Dr. Wood has got. And, you know, we've spoken particularly because of the investigation she's done into 9/11, how, you know, how your life has prepared you for doing this job, as it were. It's not really, you know, not really a job in terms of when you get paid for, but it's one that you've ended up doing because, you know, apparently nobody else seemed to be up to it, basically. It's that was basically how it came about, wasn't it?
Yes, I waited for somebody else to do it. You know, I wanted to do my research and get grants. You know, everything you do with you know, faculty position and teach courses. And this was somebody else's job, you know, not my job. But I got to a point where I realized somebody else wasn't going to do it. And whose job is it to do it? It's our job. It's our planet, our country, our planet. And always saying it's somebody else's job leaves somebody some freedom to do whatever they darn well please, and nobody's checking them.
This is it, isn't it? I mean, you know, we, various of my tax pounds and your tax dollars are used, you know, paid to these official bodies to do investigations and produce, you know, do auditing of these large organisations to make sure that they are doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. And yet, certainly with 9/11 and you know, many other guests that have been on this show before will have found the same sort of things, that these jobs are not being done. They're not done properly, you know, for various reasons, you know, corruption, self-interest, vested interests, and so on. But with 9/11, this seemed to go beyond all the boundaries that certainly that I'd encountered, and we'll probably try and talk a little bit about those as we go through the program today. But, you know, certainly in terms of the official reports that were done, we had the so-called 9/11 Commission report, and that was finished in a bit around about 2003 or 2004. And this was a 500-page report about essentially security failings and how these alleged hijackers, you know, got through the security grid, or however you might characterize it. But many less people seem to be aware that, as well as these reports, there were additional, even longer reports produced called the NIST reports, which formed the basis for Dr. Wood's investigation, or at least to some extent they formed the basis, or the basis of a challenge to those reports. And we'll talk about that after the break. Week I'm pretty sure he'll be back next week. He'd asked us to fill in for him, so we at short notice put a few things that hopefully people will find interesting and important, so put those together. And I've got with me Dr. Judy Wood, and we're going to be talking primarily about 9/11 and see where we go with that. We've got a lot to cover on that, and we'll try and take some callers in the second hour, and the number to call is 1-800-313-9443. And we already started talking about 9/11 and the fact that Dr. Wood has been investigating 9/11 since, well, more or less the day it happened. And essentially what we need to cover here really is the US government's technical reports on the destruction of the World Trade Center. And this brings me on to another thing that we wanted to mention, which we occasionally get asked, in that when we investigate 9/11, why don't we, or when we talk about 9/11, why don't we talk about the Pentagon and Shanksville sites? And really, I mean, the answer to that is because of the amount of available evidence to actually show what actually happened. And there is much, much more available evidence from the World Trade Center site than there is from the other two sites. So it becomes, it's a longer process to determine what happened, but overall it's easier because you have more evidence. And we'd started to talk about...
Let me also add, when I was, my own intuition went to wanting to deal with what happened to the towers from the beginning, mm-hmm. seeing these magnificent buildings, you know, unraveling into dust. It was just bizarre. But also, as I gathered that together, the only official report that we could even attack or go after was on the towers. There's no public report on the Pentagon. So if you're going to go after the ones who are in charge, there's no avenue there. And as citizens, we can't file criminal charges, but we can file charges against contractors for the U.S. government. But there was no avenue with the Pentagon.
Right. I mean, that's also a very important point. I was thinking about it slightly differently, but of course that's more important than what I was thinking, really, because, you know, you can investigate something just for your own interest, or you can investigate it with the objective mm-hmm. of taking some action. And, you know, I think it became clear after a while, and, you know, as you were saying in the introduction, that there was a need to take some action because the people that were supposed to be doing that weren't doing it. And so that brings me back to what we just started to mention, and that's the NIST reports. And NIST is the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And they were given a mandate by Congress to do a formal investigation of the destruction of the World Trade Center towers. Now, I can't remember when that mandate was given, but I'm guessing it was sometime in 2003.
I was thinking 2002, but
was it?
But anyway, it could have been 2003, somewhere in there.
Somewhere around that period. And I think there was a budget set of, and it ended up being, I think, about $16 million. Mm-hmm. And various contracts were drawn up by NIST, because they themselves didn't really do the investigation. They contracted companies with expertise to do various reports for them, sub-reports, if that's the correct name for them. And these were compiled into 10,000 pages of overall reports about the destruction, and you can actually download all of these for free if you wanted to do that. And within those reports, there are, you know, hundreds of pictures and tables and so on. But essentially, all of that report, all of those reports, and all of that research, was just backed up the official story, which was that the towers basically caught fire. The steel became weakened because of the fire, and then the buildings collapsed under their own weight or something along those lines, and they came up with this supposed pancake model. And all of the reports backed up that conclusion.
But one thing quite interesting is, and I think it's due to the Smith-Mundt Act, and I'll let you describe what that is, that they had to put correct information in the report. They couldn't put photoshopped images. And they put correct data in the report. Now, they can misunderstand the data, misinterpret it, make the wrong conclusions, but the data in there was actually correct data. The raw data, we're not talking about their models. Their contractors made up models based on who knows what. But the actual physical evidence, like the seismic reports, you know, and how long this happened and when this happened and so forth. So there is actually correct information in there, but they just don't know what to think of it, so they ignored it.
That's a very important point that, you know, as you say, that there was a lot of treasure trove of data in those reports, but then they kind of, you know, they put wool over it and dressed it up in various ways, and as you say, did various computer models, some of which were done by a company called Applied Research Associates, which we'll probably maybe talk about a bit more if we get time. So they're of particular interest to myself and Dr. Wood. And so these reports essentially backed up the official story, and they came out in, I think it was it August 2005? When
September 15th, 2005.
Oh, was it? It was a little bit later than I'd realized.
That was a preliminary one, but then the final one. You know, and they want comments or something.
Right, so they published it for comments, and then they finalized it in September 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I think the point that I always like to mention is we have the Brigham Young physicist Stephen E. Jones. He went on the Tucker Carlson show and said that the collapse of Building Number 7 was which didn't even collapse, the destruction of Building Number 7 was anomalous and all of this, and so he came onto the scene. I think around about the time the NIST reports came out, I think I'm correct in saying that, aren't I?
Yes, right after it came out, it kind of was a package deal.
Yeah, it seemed to be that there was some relationship between this happening, which is very strange, seeing there was no connection, Stephen E. Jones wasn't working for NIST or anything like that. So we had those technical reports published in 2005.
I would like to add just a sample of what was in those reports. Mm-hmm. For example, Building 7. It was whisper quiet, and they even said how there's no significant seismic signal, and there were some of the stations, seismographic stations, couldn't even pick up any anomaly from background noise. Yet you have this humongous building supposedly slamming to the ground, and they had all sorts of witness testimony and audio testimony. They had a video of somebody being interviewed right down the street from there, and the building just drops down behind them, and then the cameraman says, whoa, he just saw this building go down, but he didn't hear anything. And there are people who are like who just happened to not be looking at it, like, where'd the building go? And it was incredible. But that evidence is in the report.
That's it, and it's very important to sort of understand what we were saying earlier on about the data being correct in the report, but they put the wrong interpretation on it. And not only did NIST do that, the follow-up, when people started to question this, the 9/11 truth movement did it as well, because, what you can call that, they claimed that building number 7 was controlled, classic controlled demolition, I think is the phrase that's trotted off the tongue of many people who think that they know the truth about 9/11 and what happened to the World Trade Center complex. And of course, what Dr. Wood just described does not match with standard controlled demolition, because it's very noisy. You get all the initial explosions from the the detonations going off, and then you get the rumbling of the actual building coming down.
It should have sounded like it was raining dump trucks.
Yeah, that's an expression we use. We've used several times. So we have multiple questions there, and again, some of these we'll aim to look at after the break. Wherever you may be in the world, listening to us on the Ralph Winterode Show, as you probably already guessed, I'm not Ralph Winterode. I'm actually Andrew Johnson, and I'm talking to you from England. And I have with me an esteemed guest, Dr. Judy Wood, who's in the USA. And we're also, we're basically talking about 9/11. We've been covering some of the aspects of Dr. Judy Wood's research, and we're going to talk more about that. If you want to find out more about us, you can look at our respective websites, drjudywood.com, and we're going to give out another website shortly when we get to why that website exists. And you can look at my website too, which is called checktheevidence.com, and there's lots of stuff on there for you to look at and work through, and I hope you'll find the information of benefit, because that's my objective in putting the information there, is for other people's benefit. And we were talking about the technical reports that were produced about the destruction of the World Trade Center, and we covered about talking about World Trade Center number 7. And basically, these reports were produced in 2005, and what they said about the cause of the destruction of the World Trade Center was basically false. The cause that they gave and the explanations they gave were incorrect, even though much of the data that was in there was correct and useful. The conclusions that they gave were wrong, and they were wrong for reasons which I'll try and get to. But basically, this resulted in a bit later in the history of what we're telling you, in a challenge to the report. So, is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, it's technically a little bit different than that because, okay. and I think it was designed that way, that they were mandated by Congress to determine why and how the towers collapsed. Well, the towers didn't collapse; they couldn't prove that. They just ignored that. They decided not to do that. Instead, they made a probable hypothetical whatever collapse model, and then generated this fictitious model, and then sort of substituted that in and said, well, they only analyzed the building while it was still standing. This came up when I submitted my request for correction to NIST. So they didn't analyze the collapse, and I pointed out that their model of the tipping top of the building violated the laws of conservation of momentum. And they said, no, it didn't, because we didn't analyze the collapse. So the building was standing as long as it was still standing, and it was obeying the laws of physics while it was still standing, because right. they ended their responsibility while the building was still standing.
Yeah, well, that came a bit later, and I think we just need to explain a bit of background to that.
Okay.
Because I think that, that's all true, of course. But what actually happened was these reports were produced, and then they essentially stood unchallenged for almost 2 years, I think, didn't they? And then you were contacted, was it in 2006? I think it was in 2006, yeah. By Jerry Leapart.
I guess what I'm commenting on, they weren't commenting on the evidence. They had the evidence in there, but that wasn't, they didn't make a wrong conclusion about the evidence. They just didn't even talk about it. They just produced this other substitute. So in case they're looking for plausible deniability and saying what they showed wasn't wrong. So that's what I mean. It's a fine line they're walking.
Right. So they knew what they were doing. It was pretty much premeditated by the people that were actually in control of the reports. Maybe the people that did the little bits of the projects didn't really know what they were doing as such, other than what they've been told to do. But anyway, Jerry Leapart contacted you, I think, in 2006, and he highlighted that there was an opportunity to actually take NIST, or the contractors ultimately, to task for, what you just said, for the incorrect interpretation of the data that they had and the conclusions that were in that report, because those reports were wrong. They were incorrect, and in fact, because of that, they were low in quality, because they had a low quality analysis, perhaps I might put it that way. And so you, under Joe Leapart, advised you that under the Data Quality Act, you could actually put together a challenge and challenge NIST's report, to point out these errors that you discovered in their analyses and so on. And I think it was in 2007 that you actually put that into a sort of a documentary format. And this was what you just mentioned there, the RFC, or the request for correction, whereby you told them that the analysis was incorrect, and you highlighted, I think, what, 50, 60, 70, 100 different points. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact figure. And you wrote a 50-page document, I think it was, wasn't it, initially?
Or 54 or something like that, somewhere.
And all this is on drjudywood.com, the website, and you can just do, tinyurl.com/911qtam, I know that's a mouthful, but if you just Google Dr. Judy Wood, QTAM, 911, you'll get to the page, I'm fairly sure. It's the Google censorship is not quite that comprehensive yet, thankfully. So you put together this document with the help of attorney Jerry Leapart. That went into NIST, I think, in early 2007, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the 16th of March, 2007. And it was telling this, you know, you have errors, you know, fatal errors in your thing. Well, first of all, they didn't analyze the collapse. So they shouldn't call it a collapse because they didn't determine it was a collapse. And the name of the report was something like the final report on the collapse of the towers 1 and 2. But they didn't analyze the collapse.
And that was the amazing thing, that you actually got a letter from them saying that, didn't you, once you'd submitted this document.
They admitted it. They confirmed it.
Yeah. Yeah, and this was incredible. We found this quite incredible when we saw this document, that they actually admitted that it was fraud. And it was almost like, I mean, they didn't really need to say that, did they? They could have tried to dress it up somehow, but they didn't. So, you know, one line of thinking says that perhaps they were saying, well, we know that you're right, but there's nothing we can do, kind of thing. You know, we've done as much as we can, you know, so we're basically admitting to you that, you know, this is a stitch-up. And we've been stitched up, but they couldn't obviously say that like that.
They were bound to be honest. You know, they had to be honest. And so it depends on what kind of question you ask them as to what you get out. Like, you know, you're talking about, it wasn't that they gave the wrong answers to what they had. They just decided they could not analyze the collapse, because if they did, there's no way out. They couldn't come up with a wrong decision, a wrong conclusion. So they didn't analyze the collapse. Instead, they manufactured a fictitious scenario and then gave that as their answer. And based on that scenario, you know, that fictitious model, that's what their conclusions were based on. So they didn't have to lie.
Yes, and it was basically a setup then. So they set the parameters of what they were going to do and worked within those parameters. Whilst really those parameters were, you know, they were unrealistic. They were, those parameters really, we were just so narrow that they weren't even able to actually do a proper investigation, which was why the report was challenged by you and Jerry Leapart. So that was 2007. I think you had an appeal, didn't you? There was an initial sort of submission, and then an appeal when they denied the request.
And so they initially denied it, and this was just another way to get in more information, because the purpose of filing the request for correction may be something that most people aren't aware of. But in their response, you know, I've talked about in my initial submission that Applied Research Associates and SAIC, you know, these various companies, it was a conflict of interest, because they're developers and manufacturers of energy weapons and, you know, various other things. And and NIST wrote back to me saying, oh, we didn't know that. Show us, you know, we don't have any proof of that. Oh, okay, so here's the proof. I gave them proof. And they responded to the appeal saying, oh, but we specifically put in their contract they weren't to tell us what happened.
Yes, yes.
They're just supposed to model what we want them to model.
That's right. And I think, again, we need to mention why that's so significant here. This, you know, we haven't talked about directed energy weapons yet, because, you know, we'd gone through, we haven't even got to that part, really, because we'd more gone through to what challenges were made to the official reports.
I'd like to say what the motivation was from. And I didn't quite understand at the time when Jerry Leapart was encouraged me to put together what my beef was with the NIST report. Okay, and label everything. And all of the contracts, you know, did this. I remember one of the issues was, you know, the plaza is normally not covered with dirt. Now, here's a picture right after the demise of the towers, and the plaza level's covered with dirt. And ARA should know this. I remember making that statement. These things that the contractors should have noticed. And those were stated there for a reason. I was being a whistleblower.
Right. And we're going to talk more about this whole, you know, thing with the directed energy weapons after the break.
World-renowned physicist.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you may be listening. This is the Ralph Winterroad Show, and I'm not Ralph Winterroad. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I'm talking to you from England. And I have with me Dr. Judy Wood. And we're filling in this week for Ralph, who will be back next week. And well, the topic of our conversation tonight is primarily about 9/11, because Dr. Wood has done a comprehensive investigation into the destruction of the World Trade Center, which you can find out more about from drjudywood.com. And I've been also involved with some of the research that she's done from a slightly different angle, which again we'll try and get on to talk about. And my name's Andrew Johnson, and I have a website called checktheevidence.com. And we started to talk about these technical reports, which were produced in 2005, which Dr. Wood challenged. And she essentially established herself as a whistleblower, actually showing that these reports were incorrect, the analyses were incorrect, although there was very much a large amount of useful data in these reports, and also that these reports were produced by contractors, private companies who'd contributed. And what I wanted to talk about was that we'd mentioned this directed energy weapon connection, but we hadn't really sort of got onto why we'd actually started to talk about that, why this is so very important. It's actually the key concept here that Dr. Wood discovered from studying the evidence, as she did over several years.
Can I insert here something?
Yes.
A lot of people don't quite understand what's getting at. This isn't about guessing an answer. This has nothing to do with theory. This has to do with what the evidence shows. And what the evidence shows is you can rule out that kinetic energy, any kind of kinetic energy mechanism, was the destructive mechanism for the buildings. You can also rule out that thermal energy weapons were what caused the building to be destroyed. You know, all this unburned paper flying all over town. I mean, the building was not cooked to death, and it wasn't beaten to death. That's what it means by ruling out kinetic energy. But the building turned to dust. Basically, most of the building turned to dust in midair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way that you put it in a very quick summary is that, you know...
Didn't burn up, didn't slam the ground, turned to dust in midair. We know that
because... That's exactly what I was thinking of. I mean, we've covered this quite a lot before, so, you know, perhaps not go through it here, but I encourage people to go through all of it here, but I encourage people to, you know, look at the various videos easily found through Google, through our websites. This is done in great detail in these videos. We're going to talk about Dr. Wood's book in a short while, but we, you know, it's not as if we're trying to sell this book, because, you know, much of the information is available for free. The book is kind of the definitive, organized, fully referenced, etc. version, which has been pinned down, and so that's, if you can afford it, that's the version to have. And again, we'll talk about the development of this shortly, but
The important part is the evidence rules out kinetic energy weapons or thermal energy weapons being the destructive mechanism.
Right.
But it doesn't rule out directed energy. That's not, you know, any specific thing. These are categories of weaponry or categories of technology.
Right. And of course, what we need to point out is that, as you said, the buildings, in fact, mostly turned to dust before they hit the ground. And this is what your study has established beyond all doubt. And, you know, so then you have to try and look at, again, from looking at the evidence, you know, how that happened, kind of, or what was involved in doing that. And as you said, it wasn't something that crashed into the buildings. It wasn't the buildings caught fire and a process resulting from an ordinary fire caused the destruction. It was something else, some other things that were going on. And you can establish what some of those goings on were by, again, looking at the evidence. And this is where you eventually get to the conclusion, the only conclusion, that it must have been some type of energy weapon, or one or more, that we'd never seen before. We hadn't seen this used in this way, in this environment. However, what Dr. Wood discovered in 2007, and this was around the time that I'd started to, you know, talk to her, as I'm talking to her now over Skype, that there was this other process which had been developed by a researcher called John Hutchison, and that he'd been developing this process since 2003. And so if you'd like to tell us a bit more about that just for now, and then we can maybe go on to these other energy connections.
Well, the first thing I did And it's important to go in a particular order when you conduct an investigation to first determine what happened, independent of anything else. Because then you're not biasing, you're not cherry-picking, you know, here's the answer, and then cherry-pick backwards to find the data to support it. Now, so I had tabulated all the different phenomena I saw. It was just a tremendous amount of phenomena that was just weird. And I had categorized some. I had no idea what they meant. Like this, the doors of the vehicles just split in half, but these doors aren't laminated, so why are they peeling in half? And then this one night, I was wandering around the web and came upon a blog, somebody's blog, and I went, wait a minute, all these images, they had reproduced every single one of the phenomena that I had been tabulating. I'm like, wait, I got to go meet this guy. And that was John Hutchison.
Yeah, and John's a Canadian researcher. He'd been doing these experiments using various sort of bits of equipment, up to 2 tons of equipment. And the thing which I found very interesting as well, when we started talking to John, I was actually already familiar with John's research, at least to a small extent. I'd come across it in 1999. And I remember hearing at some point that he'd been visited by Colonel John Alexander from Los Alamos National Laboratories. And,
for 4 months.
I remember hearing. Yeah.
They filmed him around the clock for 4 months.
Yeah, and this was, so we knew that there was a connection to, you know, essentially the heart of the military-industrial complex, and John had openly told us that, you know, he'd had a fan club in the Pentagon. What exact form that took, I don't know, but he'd been offered contracts with the DOD of some kind, and he had contacts who had, looked at his work, evaluated it, and so on. And John Alexander had been on Coast to Coast, and I'd got some documents from somebody that showed that John Alexander had been working for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which, of course, if people don't know, is where they developed the atomic bomb. So then, with Dr. Wood's research, this then was at least in the way that the evidence was laid out connected to 9/11. We're not saying that John Hutchison is personally connected to 9/11, or we're not saying that, you know, John Alexander took John Hutchison's experiments and turned them into a weapon that was used then to destroy the World Trade Center. We don't know that. We don't have the evidence for that.
But we know they're aware of what he was doing.
We know that they were aware of what we were doing, and we know that from looking at the evidence from John Hutchison's experiments, which again has been gathered over 20-odd years, you know, he had 500 pounds of metal samples. He'd had a report done by the Canadian government on his own research, which was classified, and that was that information was given to John by a Canadian MP with the wonderful name of Chuck Cook, and that's all documented on John's website and John's blogs. So we'd come across all of this stuff. Dr. Wood had come across most of this stuff. I'd come across bits and pieces of it in 2007. And
Andrew, why is that car upside down?
Yeah, this is the other thing that people, most of the 9/11 truth men will not talk about it. Things like, as we said, just as within the NIST reports, evidence was ignored. Within the 9/11 truth movement, evidence is being ignored, and people will not talk about the upside down cars, and they will not talk about people like David Hanscher, who was a photographer for the New York Daily News, and he was. He reports on the Charlie Rose program that he was levitated and carried a block.
Yeah, picked up like you're picked up by a tornado and carried about a block.
That's right. And that was a very peculiar expression there that he used there to say being picked up by a tornado, because that was another line of investigation that you looked at, wasn't it, as you progressed through the evidence. And
that it's the same kind of phenomenon that exists with tornadoes. It's a natural occurrence of the same type of thing. You know, why do you have a car on top of a telephone pole? The car didn't tumble there. Or you have the roof off of a house with nothing inside the house disturbed.
Yes.
It's not wind.
And it appears to be some, you know, there appears to be some it's certainly known to somebody, but it's unknown to us, or poorly understood interaction between some form of energy field and gravity. That's what seems to have been going on, and it's very difficult for people to grasp this.
It's electricity, magnetism, and gravity. All of those are interrelated.
Yes. And we're going to talk about more after the break where this takes us and some very important territory that it takes us into. Hello, and wherever you may be in the world, good morning, good evening, good afternoon. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me on the programme on the Ralph Winterroad Show, Dr. Judy Wood, and we're filling in this week because Ralph is taking a little time off. He'll be back next week, and we're going to try and take some callers this hour. So if you want to call in, the number is 1-800-313-9443. And you can find out more about myself and Dr. Judy Wood by visiting our websites. CheckTheEvidence.com is my website, and DrJudyWood.com is, not surprisingly, Dr. Judy Wood's website. We're talking primarily about 9/11, and there's some other things I want to get onto before we take a couple of callers. And we were talking about the evidence which shows the type of... the way in which the World Trade Center was destroyed, which was with some type of directed energy weapon. And building on that, we started talking about the Hutchinson effect, which is an energy set of energy-related effects, and how that something like that was involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I wanted to get the connection here because some of the people that were involved in producing these technical reports, some of the companies, actually are involved with the production or design or research into directed energy weapons systems. So this is, to us, it's no coincidence. To others, they don't have a clue what we're talking about because this evidence is completely censored in the mainstream, and also it's censored within the 9/11 truth movement, which I'm hoping to get onto a little bit, because that's what I've written a lot about. So I think we would just want to do a little bit more about the energy connection here, and then I also wanted to talk a little bit about the dust as well. So I think Dr. Wood wanted to say something about the energy connection and also the evidence.
Well, as for the energy connection, as we said earlier, it rules out kinetic energy being the method of destruction, or thermal energy, but it does not rule out directed energy. And it's a very broad category. No, it's not laser beams from space. No, it's not masers or whatever. It's not a point source. What I mean by directed, it doesn't contact it. It's not a big hammer or lots of little hammers hitting something, or bombs or missiles or something hitting it. That's kinetic energy. Or even, right, you know, pancake collapse, that would be kinetic energy. Right. If it was heat and melted the building, that's thermal energy. You'd have burned up paper all over the place. Or right. a nuke would be, you know, produces heat, lots of heat. You didn't have evidence of high heat. A lot of people say, absolutely, well, we saw, you know, or people said they saw liquid metal. Well, that doesn't mean it was high heat. If you have first responders wading through it and they're not burning up, how hot can it be? But it may look like it. That's why it takes someone with experience looking at the evidence to see what is actually there, not quickly trying to plug into a multiple choice test. And so the directed energy, that is, it's energy is directed, instructed, you could think of it, is instructed to do something differently than it normally does. It's also directed geographically, you know, WTC buildings, you know, anything with a WTC prefix, you know, gets included. But it's not random, like, you know, a bomb going off goes in all directions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things I wanted to get in as well, I mean, all this evidence is on the website and in the videos, mm-hmm, so I encourage people to watch that through the websites that I've mentioned if you know, we've gone too quickly, because I appreciate we're, you know, covering a lot of this very quickly. So do take your time to look through this. It's very important. But one of the things I wanted to mention
This is something that often confuses people, because they think of direct energy being a specific weapon, and it's not.
Yes.
It's a category, like kinetic energy or thermal energy.
Right. But there's also a deliberate effort on the internet to actually, you know, to encourage people to do that, to focus on one type of energy weapon, isn't there? I mean, that's another thing, right, I wanted to get onto as well. And that people do that because they watch science fiction films and stuff. But I think over and above that, as I'm going to try and speak about a little bit, people are encouraged to do this when they're characterising the research that you've done. You know, so
yeah, more than normal. But as for the dust, the dust, you know, if you have pulverization from kinetic energy, you have vaporization from high heat. Neither of those apply. If you hit something with a hammer, you know, the pieces break into, you know, with pulverization, break down to a certain size, but they aren't the size that was found at the World Trade Center. That dust is so tiny, it just gets inhaled into your bloodstream. It's the size of about 1/100th of the red blood cell size, of DNA.
So we have this basically, you know, it's the dust landed following the demise of the buildings, and then it started to go up, didn't it, from the ground, or part, some of it did, small amounts of it did.
It had strange behavior that it went up. It rolled out for a certain distance, and then it started going up, almost like there was a reaction in it that made it go up.
And then you can see this in the Bob and Bree video. That's the one that's primarily the one that where you can actually see this right in the video with this going up.
It's like rising yeast bread.
Yeah, and it kept on going up and up and up and up and up. And I remember you telling this, what you were doing is you were trying to find out more about the way that this stuff was moving and how far it was going.
Exactly. How far up did it go? And you could see it from some, you know, airplane pictures. Well, let's go look at weather satellite pictures just to see how far up it goes, because maybe it can be viewed there. And then I got these weather satellite images and went, what the heck is that? It's this big, huge hurricane sitting right outside of New York City.
This is the thing that, again, most people will not talk about, because to me, when you study this, when you study what the hurricane did, or rather its movements, and where it went and the timing of it, I certainly concluded myself, you know, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but that this was somehow involved in the events of 9/11 itself, you know, and when you start to put this on the table for people, they tend to really often don't really know what to do with it. And so if you'd like to just describe the movements of this, this Hurricane Erin.
I avoid theorizing about it because just to be able to stay with exactly what the evidence is, but in analyzing the evidence, okay, you have this hurricane that for 4 days is aiming straight towards New York City, you know, perpendicular straight towards the coast, not up the East Coast, but out from sea directly, you know, from Bermuda directly to New York City. And on day one, because there's this high pressure system from the west, they thought it would turn around sometime. Day one, in the little text messages that were recorded, it says they thought it was going to turn around. Well, it didn't. On day two, they thought it was going to turn around. It didn't. Day three, they thought it was going to turn around. It didn't. Day four, they thought it was going to turn around. Good thing they did, because they're out of time. It was right outside of Manhattan. The thing stopped, you know, made a 110-degree turn or so, then that afternoon started heading out of town. About 8 a.m., it was the closest to New York City. I'm not talking about the center of it, but I'm talking about the whole thing, because it got larger when it stopped. You know, like a figure skater putting out their arms to slow down. But it still stayed a hurricane status, and for several days after that too. So it turned around then went up the East Coast, but it was sitting there. And so you have to ask the question: how could somebody be so sure that they didn't warn anybody? Even, use those voluntary evacuations before they require, you know, mandatory evacuations, like with Hurricane Rita. You know, maybe, you know, get a head start in case somebody needs to get out of Manhattan. It's hard to leave because those people don't have cars. And so, for you know, it's not that they're worried about it mowing down the city. You know, that's what, but more than that, it's sitting there outside the city. If it sits there for a little bit longer, you're going to have storm surges, and Manhattan's just about at sea level.
And of course, this is what happened with the
Sandy,
and we had a whole build up to that, and we had no such build up to Erin. This is what's so strange about this data, and I really encourage people to study this because it's really significant. And we're going to talk more after the break. Well, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be around the world. You're listening to the Ralph Winterroad Show, and my name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me Dr. Judy Wood. We're filling in for Ralph this week. He'll be back next week. Very shortly, we're going to try and take some callers, and the number to call is 1-800-313-9443. Thank you for listening to us. And we just mentioned there about Hurricane Erin, but I wanted to bring in also the energy connection, because this is very important to what we're talking about. And, for example, the role of a character we'd mentioned, the role of a character we mentioned earlier on, Stephen E. Jones, and he was involved in energy research in the late 1980s, and that energy research became known, thanks to Stephen E. Jones, as cold fusion. Now, that essentially, like a lot of names that are applied to Dr. Wood's research, was a misnomer. It was an incorrect, inappropriate name, and it should really have been called low-energy nuclear reactions. And that seems to also be, to some extent, applicable to what was going on at the World Trade Center site, because it appeared, certainly to me, that after the events, there were some low-energy nuclear reactions going on, which created something called tritium. And this, again, is a very important piece of evidence which the 9/11 Truth Movement, as well as the NIST reports, do not talk about very much. And I wondered if you'd like to elaborate on the tritium evidence, Dr. Wood, a little bit.
Right. I'd also insert in here the title of my book, and why I say this is evidence of free energy technology. The technology used on 9/11, there's proof that such a technology exists because of the evidence. But that technology doesn't need to be used for evil. It can be used for good, like providing free energy. Mm. Not that a free energy gizmo, whatever, but it's the same technology. It can use it for good or bad. And the tritium is something that is a byproduct of this low energy nuclear reaction process, as well as helium. Now, we have no way of proving helium, but wow, that sure looks like what happened with the rising heat spread appearance of the dust clouds. At a certain point in the reaction, the dust starts just going up. And it's pretty bizarre. But what we do have an actual measurement of is the tritium, which is about 50 times what was found in the cells with the LENR, low energy nuclear action experiments. But what you found in the bottom of the basement of WTC-6 has been watered down with fire hoses and rain by the time they measured it. They measured it something like 10 or 11 days after 9/11. And at that point, it had, it was 1/50th. I mean, it was 50 times background. But in LENR, it's even 50 times that. But if it's a leaking nuclear plant, the fission plants, it's like 18,000 times what was found at the World Trade Center. It's totally different ballpark of numbers rather than, something just watered down a little bit. So this really, it looks like it's, 50 times background level is definitely an elevation. There's something that caused that.
Right. I mean, it wasn't just an experimental error or something when they measured it. And I think it's hugely important to actually understand what this indicates. To me, what this clearly indicates is that somebody like Stephen E. Jones, who worked directly in the field of low-energy nuclear reactions, I think he was brought onto the scene to try and steer people away from discovering the importance of tritium and the energy effects were involved in the destruction of the towers. I think that's got to be why he was put onto the case. I don't think it's just a coincidence. And if you read Dr. Eugene Mallow's book, which is called Fire from Ice, you can read about the role of Stephen E. Jones in kind of, we describe it as a muddle-up of the work of the chemist Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons in the late 80s, early 90s. That's a whole other separate program. And so that was one aspect of this. We've also had many people trying to say that nuclear devices, conventional nuclear devices, were involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I would contend that the reason for that is that is also they try and explain the tritium as a result of a conventional nuclear or fission-based reaction, as it's called. And, you know, I actually had somebody writing to me about that, and it was extremely rude. They seemed to be quite desperate to promote this nonsense onto me. And so I would encourage people to investigate what's on our websites and write to us if they want more information.
But we're not, eliminating, a nuclear process. It is indeed a nuclear process, but it's not a fission nuke bomb or, a neutron bomb.
Yeah.
And the neutron bomb is, it's even more insane because neutron bombs kill people, not buildings.
Yes.
It was more the opposite.
This is something that this Jim Fetzer character came out with, and he's a person who initially appeared to be friendly to the research that we were trying to do, and then essentially turned quite hostile, which we won't talk about too much here. You can read about that in my book, 9/11, Finding the Truth. So to go back to the course of events, we're going to take a call soon, but to go back to the course of events, Dr. Wood did the court case, and we didn't get onto the court case. She did the request for correction, and then you took legal action in the form of a QI-TAM case because you had been a whistleblower, which was essentially a science fraud case, wasn't it? So
yes.
Can just cover that briefly.
And being a whistleblower qualified me to file the QI-TAM case, which is also known as a whistleblower case. You have to be the first, and you need to show that there was fraud involved. Heck, we had missed admitting there was fraud, and there's no question I'm the first. I'm still the only one that stood out there about this what happened with the energy weapons. But what happened with that, the lower court denied it for, they ignored that I had filed this request for correction to NIST, and they ignored anything else I submitted, and then said they weren't going to hear a case about who shot JFK or what landed on the moon, and several other things like that that weren't what the case was about. And it went to, we appealed it to the Court of Appeals, and they were respectful enough to even write in the footnote of the written decision that they were ignoring the law to dismiss the case. They could not abide by the law and dismiss the case because I had indeed shown that I was the first and fraud was involved. We had NIST admitting fraud was involved.
And so that essentially went also to the Supreme Court, but of course they refused to hear it. So, you know, once you'd been through those legal avenues,
let me add one thing there. And it wasn't, a lot of folks say it was thrown out, it was laughed out. The other side, of course, had moved to dismiss because they didn't want this in court. And they also wanted me sanctioned for filing a frivolous case. None of those steps along the way was it ever determined to be a frivolous case, and I was never sanctioned or fined.
Right, and that's very important. And going back to the so-called 9/11 truth movement, they were actually celebrating when this case was not heard and when it was thrown out of court. We had people actually posting on forums that this was a good thing, and so on. And this is just ridiculous. This shows the length to which psychological operations have been successful in actually covering up most of this information. And that's one thing I've been very carefully documenting since 2007. You can read all about this on my website. And one of the other interesting little bullet points I think we should cover is that Science Applications International Corporation, the company that does research into directed energy weapons, what's one of their other special areas of interest?
Psychological operations.
Right.
And they, what they were involved in the NIST report is putting it together. They were listed in the contract as entering, equations.
We'll talk more after the break. Wherever you are in the world, thank you for listening to us. I say us because my name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me Dr. Judy Wood, and we're filling in just this week for Ralph Winterode, who's taking a break. We'll maybe take one or two callers this hour, and the number is 1-800-313-9443. Dr. Wood and myself are talking primarily about 9/11, and we talked about the whistleblower case that Dr. Wood had started in 2007, but that eventually really sort of came to a point where it couldn't be taken any further. And you can read all about that on Dr. Judy Wood's website, drjudywood.com. And I have a website called checktheevidence.com. But then sometime after the court case, Dr. Judy Wood decided that she would put all of the evidence that she could into a book. And that book was given the title, Where Did the Towers Go? For reasons which should have become clear as we've talked about this. So if you'd just like to tell us a little bit about the book.
Actually, it wasn't all the evidence. I had to pare it down because it's 544 pages. And I moved that to a future book. But it's anyone who's read the book, any honest person who's read the book, knows what happened enough. Not we don't know the what the serial numbers were, or what the operator had for breakfast, or you know those type of details, but they understand what happened physically.
Right, and I mean I'd like to just talk about a couple of things about the book because you know obviously I was involved in seeing it. Well, I saw it getting developed. I wasn't really involved in the development of the book as such, but we had Dr. Eric Larson, who very kindly wrote this wonderful preface and introduction, no, he didn't write the preface, did he?
I wrote the author's preface. He wrote the foreword.
Right, that's it. So I was getting mixed up about that. And you know, he described it as the most important book of the 21st century. So that's what he thought of it. And I think you know that's true because if you look at the effect it has on people, some people actually find it's very transformative when they read it. You know, because they get so upset that they've been lied to so much. And, you know, somebody actually said to us that if people actually get the message of what's in this book, you know, it will change the world because the people that are running the planet, whoever they are, they would be finished because of what's revealed by what's in this book. Other people will simply not look at the book. You know, they just refuse to look at it. And then some people will just, they might even look at it, but they won't take responsibility for having read it. It's that important.
I'd like to add one of the most powerful things that I didn't really see coming as I prepared the book. I was just showing so that anybody who read would see, you know, the evidence I saw that and take them through it. But what folks have come back with me saying is that it's a course in critical thinking. It's yes. Helped them see the evidence for themselves, and that's what I really wanted, is because you get so much, we get, well, this person says that, you know, you get this story, you get that story, you get that story. Oh, I don't know who to believe. Well, you can believe yourself. Here, look at the evidence yourself. You're capable of looking at the evidence. And what surprised me that I hadn't anticipated is the effect on people. It grounds them. They aren't bouncing around like a ping pong ball anymore. Who to believe, this, believe that. They know now what they believe themselves, what they understand.
And what they know from what's in the evidence.
Yep.
And that's another reason why the book is so dangerous, because it is so fundamentally based in the evidence.
And no one has been able to refute anything in it.
No. And so I think with that, what we're going to do is we're going to go to a caller, Ryan, from California. So I don't know if you can bring on Ryan and maybe he's got some questions for us.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Hi. Well, I can hear you, Ryan.
I was once what I call a believer of the 9/11 truth movement. I would say that I have never heard theory from Dr. Judy Wood concerning her book, concerning her Key Tom case, and our request for corrections. All I see is evidence. And I purely think that the 9/11 truth movement was instituted for perceptual conformity, which happens to be a chapter in Dr. Judy Wood's book, describing the fact that they want to assume the problem. They do not want you, in the 9/11 truth movement, they do not want you to know what happened. They want to assume how it happened, and they tell you what happened. And then they go on to describe who did it. Well, when you create assumptions, it's very easy to build those assumptions into a belief system. and I feel that Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is very much a religion. It's a religion of individuals that do not want to look at the evidence. They simply want to assume what happened so that they can move on with their pitchforks and torches to who did it. Obviously, that's the wrong course of action. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, Ryan, and thank you very much for making those very important points. And that, you know, that dovetailed very nicely with what we were saying, which is great. And I think that's absolutely the case, that with much, you know, the Architects and Engineers group, they focused around one hypothesis and, you know, promoting this hypothesis, and yet they don't really have any evidence on which to actually move things forward anyway. So it does become...
Well, they always talk about Building 7, you know, and what they won't talk about is that there were actually 7 World Trade Center towers destroyed in New York on that day. And the truth is, they hardly even show you images of how Building 7 was actually destroyed. They don't show images from the hours before it came down. If you actually recognize how they create this perceptual conformity, they show just maybe 5 images. You'll see all of their websites. They never want to actually show the clear evidence. They show you just enough images to gain that perceptual conformity.
Right, right. And this extends really most, you know, in most places across the internet. What you're hearing now on this program on RBN is one of the few exceptions. For example, if you go to something like Russia Today, which a lot of people look to now as being an alternative news source, or if you look at InfoWars, for example, you won't find any of this discussed. Anything that, just about everything that we've discussed in this program today, it will never be discussed as things stand currently on Russia Today, InfoWars, and many, many other sites. And, you know, this is what people have got to start to understand, that the perception management that is going on is so strong and so prevalent that it's covered most of this up, and it's kept it out of the public perception almost completely.
I will stick my neck out here and say, you know, yeah, they talk about what's in this dust baggie and get you to focus on the speck of dust in the dust baggie. Over here, look over here, the dust baggie, focus on the dust baggie. Ah, we have this dipstick test that says whatever. But what does that dust baggie have to do with what happened to the buildings? That's
right.
That's never discussed.
That's right. So, and then the other thing, you know, I mean, this says perception management. I even had this demonstrated to me again today, where I had an email from this Reinvestigate 9/11 group, which runs in the UK. It's run by somebody called Ian Henshaw, and he runs this UK website. And I actually had an email from him last year when I started to have a bit of a debate with him about why he wasn't actually talking about the forensic research that Dr. Wood has completed and submitted to court. It didn't seem to figure in his reinvestigation of 9/11 at all. His response to my questions at one point, and I put this on my website, was that I, Andrew Johnson, was personally the biggest single cause of the collapse of the UK 9/11 truth movement. That was his response to me. But of course, what we're actually finding really is that this of course is not true, because we've actually got quite a number of people who've stepped forward to help us.
I'll give you an exception here about truth movement. It depends on what you mean by that. To move the truth off the table, if you're bringing truth to the forefront, then you are kind of counter to people moving it off the table.
That's right. I suppose if we have a truth movement, then where is the truth being moved to? I suppose, you know, I'd really not thought of that interpretation of it. But yes, I mean, we should thank people like Russ and, of course, Jerry Leapheart, and Dr. Morgan Reynolds, who's, I think, probably been on this program once or twice, and obviously Ryan for calling in, and also Ralph Wintroud for having us on previously, Dr. Eric Larson, and there are a number of groups that's actually just small groups of individuals, really, that have helped us in the UK, you know, Debbie, and we've had the folks up in Scotland, Laura and Ian, and
Phil and Penzance,
they've done videos.
Ollie.
Ollie down in Penzance, and we've also had Steve Collier helping us, and a lady called Cindy Laverty contacted me from, I think she's based in New York, I could be wrong about that, but she very kindly made the 9/11 Finding the Truth into an audiobook. Matt Nouse, of course, has done some great stuff, and so we've
Rob the engineer.
This is Dr. Rob.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world listening to us, and we're filling in for Ralph Winterhound just for today, and Ralph will be back next week, and we're just talking about 9/11, and Dr. Judy was researching into the events at the World Trade Center, which we've covered, and we've actually just been thanking a few people, because we've been at this a few years now, and it's been quite a difficult journey in some ways. And but we've actually found that over time people have actually started to understand what we've been trying to do, and we just start to thank a few of those. But unfortunately, we got cut off by the commercial break, and I didn't hear the music. So, yeah. So there's a few other people we can mention as well, such as Mel Fabregas, Pete Santilli, and there's say a few more people in the UK that have helped me. Richard D. Hall in the UK. He's also been very helpful. And there's probably, we could probably thank at least 50 or 60 other people if we sat down and thought of all the names. And we haven't really done this before, and I was quite conscious that we haven't really done this on a radio interview such as this. So thank you to all those people, and thank you to anyone who's listening who actually takes the time to go and look at the information, look at the websites, which is drjudywood.com, my website, checktheevidence.com, and Dr. Judy Wood's book website, which is wheredidthetowersgo.com. So,
all one word. It's hard to type.
All
no
one
spaces
word. Yeah.
In there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, if you want any more information, feel free to contact me, contact Dr. Wood, and we'll try and write to you when we get time. I think we have another caller, which we're going to probably take us up to the end of the program. And I believe we've got Cab in New York. So if we could talk to Cab now, please.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Dr. Judy, I was surprised to hear your voice. I was waiting for Dr. Daniels to come on, and I was just thinking how great it would be if you had a show on RBN, and you could bring, bring the people that you're writing about in your book, the ones that survived, that walked out of the tower, that the whole thing just disappeared around them, and they walked down into level ground, and the people, the man who was floating down the street, and people whose cars got toasted, and just you could interview people, and you could just instruct people on your program, and then we could always find you, because I'm always looking for you online. And I never know where you are, what you're doing, and you're just my favorite. My favorite. All the things that you're teaching and things that you're doing, I like to keep up with you. And so it's really nice to hear your voice tonight on this program. And is this just going to be only today, or are you going to be on more, or what?
We're filling in for someone else for tonight, just being on Ralph's show. I'm curious, you read the book.
Yes, oh yes. I've been following your work since forever.
You can tell the listeners what you gained from the book. You're an actual reader.
Oh so. Yes. Well, it's an amazing book. It's a textbook. It's heavy. I mean, it's heavy duty picking up, and it's so well done. It's an awesome work. What can I say? I guess some of countries are using it for textbooks, engineering classes, and things like that. And it just covers all so much evidence that we never heard about. Until you came along and reported on what happened, nobody had a clue. All we knew was Sylvia Smallstorm and Alex Jones and, what they were telling us about three buildings that they said they blew them up, and they crashed down, and it was a controlled demolition. And we were told all these things, and about the smoke coming up, you know, out of the ground, and the firemen were trying to put out this fire that was raging for 3 months and all this, and, you know, and then I found you on the internet and your evidence, and it was quite the eye-opener to me, amazing information. You know, I had no idea, for one thing, about the jumpers. You know, we were all told that it was maybe 5 or 6 people that jumped, but actually, according to the evidence, which you got all the evidence, boxes and boxes of it, and interviews and tapes and everything, I guess, that there were more like 1,500 people jumping out of the building.
About 1,200, and then add to that the 343 firefighters, gets you up to 1,543.
Oh, that would be the total death, or... So 1,200 people jumping. Yeah, I
don't see. Yes.
But it's still a lot of people, a lot more than we were told. And nobody ever told us about all those cars within a half a mile radius that just kind of wilted away. The door latches missing, the engines missing, but paper cups and things like that not even burned or anything.
Or the police lights on top of the polycarbonate lights weren't melted.
Yeah, plastic things weren't melted. People floating, you know, the levitation, the fact that there was nothing left. You know, these gigantic buildings. I mean, what, like 500,000 tons or something per building, or two buildings were 500,000 tons. I don't have all the details right.
Each of the towers was 500,000 tons, and then Building 7 was another 230 tons, and so forth. I'm impressed with how much information you've been able to recall.
And then there were 4 other buildings, too. It was 7 buildings altogether, right? 7?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we were told 2, then, oh, wow, we're really smart. Now we know there's 3 buildings. But actually, there were 7 buildings, and most people go, what? What do you mean 7 buildings? And then if you try to talk to them, they go, oh, that was just debris. You know,
what
I mean, there's
the main body of Building 4.
Yeah, the main body. That's the one you showed in your book where it was cut right in half.
Yeah. It was just missing.
Yeah, like somebody took a butter knife and just cut it very neatly, and then one, that part was all gone, disappeared, poof. But the other part was pretty much intact, right? And things weren't messed up too much or anything. I mean, all these strange things. And about the hurricane, and I mean, it's so interesting and so amazing, but people aren't hearing about it. And I'm always looking on the internet, where's Dr. Judy? Where is she now? Where is she speaking? And so, man, if only you could be on RBN like 5 days a week, you know, 2 hours a day. People could call in and ask questions and stuff, and you could sell your book or something like that, you know?
Then we could
always find you. We could always find you, and we could call in. We could hear you. Is that a possibility?
Wonderful for you to call in with all this, you know, this feedback and so on. It's really great, and I think you've done an excellent job of just going over some of the main points in such a short time.
Well, I just miss Dr. Judy very much, and if I could, where are you going to be, Dr. Judy? Where, you know, are you going to be getting some more interviews or what?
I do have them here and there, and I might be on another network doing intermittent shows, but I prefer to be doing research, and I'm not good at hosting shows, not like Andrew is. Andrew's good at this.
Yeah, but you're good
at
teaching.
I'm more into the science.
Like you were teaching at your college where you were, Clemson you were, and you're such a good teacher. And people need to hear you and be taught. And if people could call
you
in. Yeah, so why don't you think about that idea? And you could, you know, hire somebody to help you do your research or something. I don't know, but.
And the whole planet.
I just miss you on the internet, and, you know, I'd like to see the whole world know about what you found out.
Oh.
And it's,
I think also that brings up another point, is that I think that's great, and I think it's a wonderful message you're giving to people here. And I think just to add on to that, you could, you know, the videos that we've put out there, you know, you can share those with other people. And I've always offered to give DVDs to people who haven't, you know, can give them out to others. So you can contact, you know, if you contact Dr. Ward, contact me through the website, and I'm quite happy to send you some materials, and you can help direct people to the right place, you know, if you feel that you can do that. It's sometimes very difficult to broach the subject with people, but, you know, I'm more than happy. I've had a few people contacting me, say, Andrew, send me leaflets, send me DVDs, and I've got all of those here to give to people when they ask for them. And so, you know, I'd encourage you to do something along those lines.
I'd like to see Dr. Judy on the radio herself 5 days a week.
Yeah. It's very wearing to do that 5 days a week, and I think, you know, we would like to be able to do that in an ideal world, but it would be very difficult. Okay, well, I think I hear the music.
Perhaps you'd like to...